Genesis chapter 35, this is part 38 of the lesson series. With a little luck, we'll get through all the way through chapter 35. So where we're picking up in Genesis 35, just kind of bringing it up to date, it's, if you remember when Jacob had left his father to go to visit his uncle Laban, one of the first places that he stopped was where first heard from God, and that's where he had the vision of the angels going up and down the ladder, commonly called Jacob's ladder, and he named the place Bethel. And if you remember, he sort of played let's make a deal with God, and promised him that he would give a tenth of everything that he had and all that, and that he would if God would be with him and keep him in this way, then he would put his trust in God, and he should be the, his Lord, and so on and so forth. And of course, that was in chapter 28, verses 18 through 22. But it's been quite a while. A lot of time has gone by. It's been 30 years since he was last there, so it's been a long time since he was last at Bethel. So 30 years really since he left his father, and of course his mother Rebecca urged him to leave because, of course this all started with Esau being mad at him and threatening to kill him. So it's now also been about 10 years since he had left his uncle Laban, sneaking out, and sort of in the middle of the night type of thing, when Laban was out in the fields leaving, and so that's how much time has passed since these events have gone on. If you remember, Jacob had built a house in Succoth and formed alliances with the Canaanites there in Shechem, which really he should not have done because it was money-making alliances. He saw opportunity to prosper financially, but there was an altar built there at Shechem, so some sort of religious activity must have been going on of some sort. But yet, spiritually, Jacob was not really what you'd say was near to God. Sort of like people that go to church on Sunday, but you wouldn't call them really spiritual people. They show up, but they're not godly, necessarily, spiritual people. And that was reflected in the events of his life and the way he conducted his life. He was supposed to go to meet Esau where in Seir, where Esau lived, but yet we find out Jacob goes the opposite way. So he obviously had reason to try to avoid contact with Esau. He sort of passively accepted the rape of his daughter Dinah there at Shechem by the Canaanites, if you remember that, and didn't do a whole lot about it other than to form an alliance which would in fact bring him financial gain. That entering an agreement that really would compromise the integrity of the covenant agreement that God had made with Abraham, Isaac, and now Jacob, and that to be a prosperous people, a godly people, and as Isaac had commanded to take a wife, but not among the Canaanites, and he was willing to let his sons intermarry with the Canaanites, and the Canaanites to intermarry with his daughters. So the godliness and the integrity obviously wasn't there. So all this, and by the way, he's not very far from Bethel, really only about 30 miles. So the proximity from Bethel was from Shechem to Bethel. Shechem's where he's living, and Bethel's only about 30 miles away. So it's not as though it's a, you know, 1,000 miles away. And so Bethel is to Jacob where the house of God is, and yet it might as well be 1,000,000 miles away as far as Jacob's spirituality. And you know, as I mentioned, many Christians today, it's not something that is foreign to our understanding. Many Christians today appear to be close to God, but the actual truth is that they're far from it. John in Revelation 2:4 talks about that type of condition where the Lord is analyzing the churches and talking about the churches in the first letters of the book of Revelation. He says in Revelation 2:4, "Nevertheless, I have somewhat against thee, because thou hast left thy first love." You know, oftentimes Christians get saved, they you know, are on fire for the Lord, but after a while things very well cool off. Sort of like falling in love with a beautiful girl, and after a while that flame of romance sort of cools off. Reality sort of sets in, and the day-to-day drudgery of a relationship sets in. Church is very much the same way, and being a part of a church, being a part of the body of Christ, is very much the same way. It seems really exciting at first. You get saved, and the promise of new things, and you're a new person in Christ, and all those things, and you don't know what to expect, and maybe your life is going to be completely different than what it was before. You know, that might be the expectations of a lot of people when they get saved and start coming to church. You know, maybe everything in my life is going to be different. But is that the reality? No, not necessarily. So, you know, once they find out that the reality isn't what their expectations thought was going to be. It's just like when you start dating that pretty little girl, you know, you think that she's going to be perfect, and then you find out, well, she gets up and goes to the bathroom just like you do. And, you know, she's not so perfect after all. And you know, we put on our pants every day, you know, one leg at a time, just like every other guy. And, you know, people aren't perfect. They're people. And so the newness of things wears off, and reality sets in, and you find out that the drudgery that was there before kind of continues on. So oftentimes people, when they're materially blessed with material goods, think that it's because of their relationship with God, whether it's a spiritual, godly relationship or not. And Jacob obviously had a lot of material wealth, and that because of the blessing of God, but it doesn't mean that he was had a close godly relationship. God, you know, before he returned to Canaan, where he was about to cross over Canaan, God hadn't talked to Jacob for 20 years. And then, you know, as he crossed the river, he wrestled with, you know, and Jacob wrestled with a man who turned out to be the Lord all night long. You know, and that's the first contact that Jacob had with the Lord, other than the Lord telling him, you know, leave your uncle's house and get back to the land of your birth. And these are the first contacts that Jacob had with the Lord for close to 20 years. So it wasn't like, you know, the Lord was conversing with Jacob and asking him his opinion on a daily basis. So, you know, it's just like the church in Revelation chapter 3, verse 15 through 17, where the Lord says, "I know thy works, that thou art neither hot nor cold." And that often described Jacob. He was just lukewarm. He had a faith, but he was never hot or cold. And I would that thou wert hot or cold, the Lord says. So then, because thou art lukewarm and neither hot or cold, I will spew thee out of my mouth, because thou sayest, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. And oftentimes, I believe Jacob didn't know his spiritual condition. I mean, the Lord had told him to get back into the land of his birth, the land of Canaan, from his uncle's house. And in reality, he was in the land of Canaan, was he not? Living amongst the Canaanites, he was in the land of Canaan, was he, Mike? So, technically, he was doing what the Lord had said. He returned to the land of Canaan. But he was supposed to go back to see his father Isaac and by way of Bethel. And he was avoiding that. He was avoiding seeing his brother Esau. He was avoiding seeing his father. He was doing everything that he was not supposed to do. And he's dilly-dallying around, and that for 10 years after he entered the land of Canaan. So was he doing what God said to do? Yeah, he was in the land of Canaan. But was he doing really what he was supposed to be doing? No, he wasn't. So God has to, as often is the case, and just like his grandpa Abraham, you know, where God had to give him the old celestial kick in the rear, you know, with the celestial foot of God, that's exactly what he has to do with Jacob. So when we, as we start chapter 35, verse 1, Jacob is going to go to Bethel because God's going to make him go. God said unto Jacob, arise. Go up to Bethel and dwell us there, and make there an altar unto God that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother. So God himself says to Jacob, go to Bethel and go make an altar. This is the same place where you went and made an altar before when I saw you there, when you fled from Esau. Now, you think about it, and it's been 10 years since God spoke to Jacob, and you've got to think, well, why didn't God tell Jacob to go to Bethel before this time? You know, Jacob entered into the land of Canaan, and God wrestled with him, and if you remember, you know, God touched his hip and put it out of his joint, and you know Jacob's hanging on the man, and so Jacob seems to have this big spiritual turnaround. Esau comes with the 400, that turns out okay, but you know Esau wants to go with him, but Jacob sends him away and goes the other direction. So why is it 10 years that, you know, why hasn't God said anything before now? Well, if you remember last week, what was the last thing that happened? Jacob's daughter, Dinah, was abused and probably raped. And Jacob's sons go and they kill all the men of Shechem. And they take all the women and children as hostages, and they take all the goods of the houses. Remember that? And what did Jacob say at the end of he thought what would happen, if you remember in chapter 34, at the end of chapter 34, Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have troubled me to make me stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house. So that's what's on Jacob's mind. He's scared to death now, because his sons have just slain all the men of Shechem. I mean, this is a big deal. This is a slaughter of all the men of Shechem. And now Jacob is scared to death that all the relatives of all these women and children that they've taken hostage aren't going to be real happy with them. And they're going to come seeking retribution. Well, So there's an urgency to getting out of Dodge. If you remember, Jacob's tent and all his family are right on the doorstep of Shechem. I mean, they might as well be residents of Shechem. They're living right there at the gate of Shechem. So there, all of a sudden, there's an urgency. We've got to get out of here. So
that's just like it was when his brother Esau came.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and what happens when you and I get in trouble? And there's all of a sudden this urgency to solve this crisis in our life. Who's the first one we turn to? That's exactly who we need. We need God on our side. In good times, we don't need God. We can handle everything ourselves. Yeah, we think we can handle everything ourselves. God's just an afterthought. Because everything's been going along just fine and dandy. As soon as things turn sour and bad, then we need God. And guess what's going on in Jacob's life? It's a bad, bad time. Because he thinks everybody's going to come after him again. And good for good reason, because they probably are. And so it's like, Lord, where are you at? I need your help. And so here's God. He says, Jacob, arise and go to Bethel and dwell there. And make a, you know, and what's the difference between now and before? Well, Jacob probably wasn't listening before, was he? For 10 years, everything had been going just fine. Jacob had been doing exactly what he wanted. He'd been collecting riches and you know, everything had been going along just as he'd planned. Now, all of a sudden, plans have changed because things aren't going as he'd planned. Now it's time to listen for the voice of God. And he did. And he hears God speaking to him. Well, if I have to go to, Jacob thinks, if I have to go to the house of God at Bethel, maybe, just maybe, here's the thought, we ought to get rid of all these idols in all the tents and hanging around. Because as it turns out, that's exactly what was going on. Remember the idols that Rachel stole from her father's house, Laban's house? Yeah. Well, those aren't the only ones that were probably there. Because in Shechem, there were a bunch of idol worshippers too. And they took all the women and children from the slain men. They probably brought all their idols. So there's probably idols all over the place. And did Jacob say, you guys can't worship idols. You can't worship tree stumps and rocks. He let all that go on until, we're in trouble. We got to get out of here. And I just heard from God. He said, go to Bethel, which is the house of God. Everybody dump their idols. We've got to get rid of them and bury them. So God doesn't see him. Yeah. Well, you can just hear the panic in his voice. So we got to hide these so God doesn't see him. So we come to verse 2. Jacob said unto his household and all that were with him, put away the strange gods that are among you and be clean and change your garments, as if this is going to impress God. And let us arise and go up to Bethel. And I will make there an altar unto God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and was with me in the way which I went. Even the women's earrings. Now, a lot of women wear earrings, don't they? But even the women's earrings, if you read Hosea chapter 2, verse 13, that's really the only hint of when that there's a verse there that there was idol worshippers who had earrings and such like. It wasn't really idol worshippers, but the women that had earrings and God didn't care for it so very much. But Jacob wasn't about to take any chances. And so he says, they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all their earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. So he didn't even want the women to adorn themselves with any jewelry or anything. He's telling them, get all the jewelry off, put on clean garments, give me all the strange gods, collecting all the stuff, and we're going to bury it so God doesn't see any of it. Everybody walk around like you're Amish, so we can impress God when we get there. As if God's just the devil. Well, and then the next thing is that Jacob's worried about the Canaanites attacking the group as they travel to Bethel. Well, God took care of them. The Canaanites feared God, and they feared the sons of Jacob. You see verse 5, and they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. So God put terror into all the cities around them so that they wouldn't pursue after Jacob and his horde of people and animals. It's just the first of many of those incidents in the Bible. The same would happen again when the nation of Israel went from Egypt to Canaan. Here in Exodus chapter 15, verses 14 through 16, as Israel traveled, the people shall hear and be afraid, talking about the inhabitants of the land that would attack the nation of Israel. The people shall hear and be afraid. Sorrow shall take hold on the inhabitants of Palestinian. Then the dukes of Edom shall be amazed. Edom, of course, being the people of Esau. The mighty men of Moab, trembling, shall take hold of them. And the inhabitants of Canaan shall melt away. Fear and dread shall fall upon them. And by the greatness of thine arm, they shall be as still as a stone till thy people pass over, O Lord, till the people pass over, which thou hast purchased. So God supernaturally made all these people and mighty men afraid to attack the nation of Israel, even though they were extremely vulnerable. So, as Proverbs 29:25 says, that safety is not anything about your own strength. It's about trusting in God. It's about the fear of the man bringeth a snare, but whosoever putteth his trust in the Lord shall be safe. And that's not just personal trust, but also when it comes to the defense of a nation. God has to lead that nation in order to be victorious. Psalm 20 verse 7 says, some trust in chariots, some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. So it's always preferable to have a small army in God than to have a large army with no God. Meanwhile, Jacob does reach Bethel, and he reaches it safely. So Jacob, verse 6, came to Luz, which is in the land of Canaan, that is Bethel, he and all the people that were with him, and he built there an altar and called the place El Bethel, because there God appeared unto him when he fled from the face of his brother. That, of course, when he left his home to go live with Laban. And here's something that we learn from Moses that we didn't know before, and that is that Rebekah had a nurse, and she was amongst the people that were traveling with Jacob. And we find here that Rebekah's nurse dies here at Bethel, which of course can only mean one thing, that Rebekah is already dead. And Rebekah's nurse had left there living with Isaac to go to Jacob to let him know, travel to let him know that, of course, his mother was dead with the news. And then stayed with Jacob to travel back to be with Isaac, I suppose, or stayed with him to live out the rest of her days. But Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, verse 8, and she was buried beneath Bethel under an oak, and the name of it is Alon Baruch. So that is something that we did not know until now, but that is an indication, of course, that Rebekah is already dead, and that Jacob knew because her nurse was already with the party. So prior to that, we had no idea, but that was, wasn't mentioned before, but there's the first mention of the death of Rebekah. We come to a verse which might be somewhat of a bit of a confusion to some. It doesn't need to be. But God's blessing is again given to Jacob. And if you remember, when we were reading about Abraham, time and time again throughout Abraham's journey, God would give blessing to Abraham, and really each time the blessing would be magnified in some way and would grow in its scope. And that's exactly what happened here. As Jacob was there at Bethel, God appeared unto Jacob again, verse 9, when he came out of Padan Aram, and blessed him. So when he came out of Padan Aram, and all that means and indicates is the return trip. Instead of the trip to Padan Aram, it's just the return trip out of that, and then it tells you which time in Bethel, and blessed him, and God said unto him, thy name is Jacob, thy name shall not be called anymore Jacob, but Israel shall thy name shall be thy name. And he called his name Israel. And God said unto him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of thee, and kings shall come out of thy loins. And the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, to thee I will give it, and to thy seed after thee will I give the land. So the blessing does in fact grow in scope. Kings will come out of thy loins, a company of nations, a nation and a company of nations that grows in scope. And so it's nothing new in the means of the way that blessings have run between God and the receivers of the covenant blessing. So that blessing and the appearance of God seems to assure Jacob that, it really would assure Jacob that the man who he encountered and was blessed by as he entered into Canaan, who he wrestled with was indeed God. Because if you notice the language there in verse 9, God appeared unto Jacob again when he came out of Padan Aram. So it would indicate that there is a second time that he's appearing to him after he was already come out of Padan Aram. And so the first time would have been the appearance of the man that he wrestled with. This would be, of course, the second time. And so there's the assurance then to Jacob that and also to us as readers, that God was indeed the one who was wrestling with Jacob there by the creek. So the blessing would also remind Jacob that he was no longer a deceiver, but his name was Israel. And so he had a job to do and a purpose to fulfill. And then God ascends visibly from talking to Jacob, which I find pretty fascinating. Of course, the Lord ascended visibly there in the first chapter of Acts. But you read in verse 13, and God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. So there's a visible ascension from Bethel back into heaven. And Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, even a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering thereon, and he poured oil thereon. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spake with him Bethel. So he set up a pillar and marked the spot. So this really served as a rededication, and more than of Jacob to his God, and even more than that, because the first time that God met him at Bethel, Jacob was alone. Jacob was alone, and so, like so many things, you know, if you were alone and God came down and you know, God spent the whole day with you, and you were alone, I mean, it would be a momentous event. But then on the other hand, you know, you could tell everybody you knew about it, and people would just say, you're crazy. You know, you're out of your mind. You might have tremendous faith, but how do you share that with anyone, really? But here is the Lord God who stood there and talked with Jacob, blessed Jacob, and then visibly ascended back up into heaven in clear sight of all that were with him. And so what this really serves also is an explanation to his family of the faith that he has kept, but hasn't really very well practiced over the years. You know, he's had a faith. He's been a poor practicer of that faith. No doubt about it. Nobody else has talked to God. Nobody else has known that much about God. Nobody else has seen God. No one else has heard from God. If you remember Leah and Rachel's response when Jacob said, you know, I just heard from God, and he says, you know, when they were living at Laban's house, and you know, Jacob comes and says, I just heard from God, and he says, we need to get out of here. And you know, what were the girl's response to that? He says, well, you know, Daddy's stolen all our things that should have been ours, and he spent all the money that should have been ours, and you know, if your God has said that we should get out of here, then we'll do whatever he says. So, you know, that's what it came down to. Because you have all these animals, and you have all this stuff, and if your God said we should leave, then we'll believe your God. But that's, you know, that's really what it came down to. You know, so.
No, they were obedient to their husband, weren't they?
Well, that's exactly right. They were just being obedient to their to Jacob. You know, it's like, well, if you had a dream, or you know, you think, you know, if you're having some kind of imagination that God's speaking to you, whatever it is, if you want to get out of here, we're getting out of here. If it's your God to say we're getting out of here, we should get out of here, we'll get out of here. If it's the tree that you know told you, we'll get out of here. If it's that stone that talked to you, you know, whatever, we'll get out of here with you. And they were, in other words, they were going to question the reason why Jacob had all the goods. Their father had spent all their dowry money and stolen all their dowry money. And so they were ready to go. As long as Jacob was taking them with him, they're ready to go. They didn't, you know, so they exhibited no faith in God whatsoever. And so, in a way, as much as I've been beaten on Jacob this whole time, for lack of spirituality, lack of faithfulness, lack of this, I mean, you know, he's sort of a man without any support whatsoever. And, you know, he's surrounded by wives and concubines and children every servants. None of them know anything about the God of his father and of Abraham. Nor do they care to know, really. And they all have their idols, and they all talk to tree stumps and rocks and this, that, and everything. And he's the only one, really, that has any faith at all. And he's maintaining this faith. And yet, he's not a tremendous practicer of it. Here is a clear explanation to his entire family, including his sons, of the faith which he has kept for all these years, for the 30 years.
Well, I just think that indicates, too, that God reads the heart. And a lot of times what we desire within us, please the Lord, it's hard to act out a lot of times.
Yeah.
Depending on circumstances, running from your enemies or you're scared. And I think it indicates that God reads the intentions of the heart. And of course, I can't. I don't know if that's all. I can read what you do. Maybe misery dead,
mm-hmm.
But God looks at the intent of man rather than more than the action.
Yeah, to a degree. Yeah. And not all of Jacob's intent was completely forthright. I mean, his intent was to, you know, just like when he was living with Laban, or you know, his intent was to always be legal in following direction and doing that which he had to do. He always was within the law, and you know, just like when God said, "Go back to the land of your birth." Yeah, he returned to Canaan. But then he went to, you know, go live right with the Canaanites and start making deals with them. Well, that was never the intent of God. God let him do it. But it's certainly, you know, is that really the an honorable intent? Is that a godly intent? There, you know.
Well, I would say no, reading that.
No. Well, it's not. Because, you know, the covenant people are to be a separate, sanctified people. And, you know, God was not going to let that stand. And you know, therefore, the boys took care of what they had to take care of. So, you know, Jacob had his downfalls, and he had lessons to learn, and a lot of them were learned the difficult way, no doubt about it. And there's always repercussions. Whenever you insist on learning lessons the hard way, there's always going to be repercussions to the lessons that you learn. And Rachel is a perfect example of that. She was the one who he loved the very most. And that was never in question. She was his first love, and I don't know that he ever fell out of love with her as far as her being the very favorite. But one of the incidents that happened, let's go on and read about it, and then we'll see what you think. They leave Bethel, and Rachel goes into labor. Verses 16 and 17. And they journeyed from Bethel, and there was but a little way to come to Ephrath, and Rachel travailed, and she had hard labor. And it came to pass, when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said unto her, Fear not, thou shalt have this son also. Now, if you remember, her first son, Joseph, Rachel named that because it was Joseph was added to me. Well, when this son is born, Rachel names this child Benoni, which is son of my sorrow, because Rachel knew she was dying, that she would die after this child was born. But after Rachel dies, Jacob would not let that name stand, and renames the son Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. So it came to pass, as her soul was in departing, for she died, that she called his name Benoni, but his father called him Benjamin. And Rachel died, and was buried in the way to Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. And Moses writes that the pillar that Jacob set up in the grave of Rachel was still standing in his day, at the time when he wrote this. In verse 20, that Jacob set up a pillar upon her grave, and that is the pillar of Rachel's grave unto this Rachel's grave unto this day. And I just put some notes in a couple of verses here that markers, grave markers and memorial markers and things such as that do serve a purpose. As markers of events and to be remembered and commemorated, they're important because there's important events that happen throughout human life and human history. Here in Joshua chapter 4, verse 4, Joshua called the 12 men. This is when they were going over the Jordan River. Joshua called the 12 men whom he had prepared of the children of Israel, out of every tribe of man, and Joshua said unto them, Pass over before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of Jordan, and take ye up every man of you a stone upon his shoulder, according unto the number of the tribes of the children of Israel, that this may be a sign among you, that when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, What mean ye by these stones? Then ye shall answer them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it passed over Jordan, the water of Jordan's were cut off, and these stones shall be for a memorial unto the children of Israel forever. So, there's markers, memorials, all kinds of things like that are erected for different reasons. So, not just grave markers, of course, but meanwhile, the death of Rachel. When you think about it, there's two ways to look at it, and there's two things that came to mind when I was thinking about it. If you remember, Rachel was jealous of Leah because Leah was having children and Rachel was not having any children, and she got mad at Jacob and demanded from Jacob that she would have children, and in Genesis chapter 30, verse 1, when Rachel saw that she bare no children, Rachel envied her sister and said unto Jacob, Give me children or else I die. Well, she demanded children of Jacob, but in fact she ended up dying in childbirth. So there's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at her death, and I believe this to be, in fact, one of the factors of her death. When Jacob was getting ready to leave Laban's house, living with Laban, he told everybody to gather up all their stuff and get ready to go. And unknown to Jacob, Rachel went into Laban's tent and gathered up the household gods, which of course would be the little statues that they, pagan statues that they prayed to. And she hid them away. And when Laban had found out that Jacob left, of course, he gathered up some men and chased him, and eventually caught up to Jacob and the party said that, well, the gods have been stolen out of his tent. And Jacob says, well, nobody stole them. Nobody here stole them. And Laban went through Jacob's tent, and he went through Leah's tent, and finally he went through Rachel's tent, and he couldn't find them. The reason was is because Rachel was sitting on them, but she says, well, I can't get up because it's that time of month, so I can't get off my horse. So unknown to Jacob, Rachel had taken the Laban's household gods, and unfortunately Jacob, not knowing that Rachel had taken it, pronounced a death sentence on whoever took the household gods. And you find that in Genesis 31:32. Jacob says, with whomsoever thou findest thy gods, let him not live. Before our brethren discern thou what is thine with me, and take it with thee. For Jacob knew not that Rachel had stolen them. So Jacob himself pronounced the death sentence on whoever had stolen the household gods. And even though there was a delay in the carrying out of the sentence, it would seem to me that sentence was eventually carried out. So, meanwhile, and you can decide for yourself, but meanwhile, as we move on, there's even more heartache in the life of Jacob. So, you know, things come back to bite you. Things that you do come back to bite you. In Genesis 35, verse 21, then Israel journeyed and spread his tent beyond the tower of Eber. And it came to pass when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. And Israel heard it. Now the sons of Jacob were 12. Now that's all Moses says about that. Almost, you almost miss it. But Reuben was the firstborn son of Leah, the firstborn of the 12. He was the oldest son born of Leah. And Bilhah was Rachel's handmaiden and Jacob's concubine. And Reuben, and of course Bilhah was probably a fairly old woman by then, but Reuben went and lay with her, and you can fill in the details there, and you think to yourself, well, what in the world is going on? Well, the end result of that is in chapter 49 that the privileges of the firstborn are taken away from Reuben. We'll get there soon enough, but when Jacob gives out the blessings to all the children, to the 12 boys, in Genesis 49, verse 3 and 4, Jacob starts with Reuben and says, Reuben, thou art my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, and the excellency of power. unstable as water, thou shalt not excel. Because thou wentest up to thy father's bed, then defilest it thou it. He went up to my couch. So Jacob, even though he did not do anything to Reuben at the time of the offense, did not forget the offense either, and took away any of the blessing that would have been given to Reuben at the time that the blessings were handed out. Now, there is probably a reason for Reuben's actions. And if you turn in your Bible to 1 Kings chapter 2, there's an explanation, and it has to do with Solomon and one of his sons. Chapter 2, verse 13 is where we're going to go. Because some of these events just sort of spring out at you, and you think, well, what in the world? Why would that have happened? So, you got to think, well, what's the reason why that would have happened? Well, Solomon became king of Israel. Of course, he was the son of David. And as you pick up the story in verse 13, Adoniah, the son of Haggith, came to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon. And she said, "Comest thou peaceably?" And he said, "Peaceably." So Adoniah was not Bathsheba's son. Now, Bathsheba's son was going to be the one that would set on the would be declared the eldest of son, by the way. But Adoniah, he was wanting to take over the position. He said, "Comest thou peaceably?" And he said, "Peaceably." He said, "Moreover, I have somewhat to say unto thee." And she said, "Say on." And he said, "Thou knowest that the kingdom was mine." So he was contesting Solomon sitting down, taking the throne. That is what this is all about, because Solomon was the son of Bathsheba. So. But he was not the oldest son. I had to think about all the relationship here. So you understand what I'm saying. Solomon sat upon the throne of David, David's throne, but Solomon was the son of Bathsheba, but he was not the oldest son. Adoniah was the oldest son. So he is contesting it. And so in verse 15 he says, thou knowest, so he's talking to Bathsheba, which is Solomon's mom. He says, "Thou knowest that the kingdom was mine, and that all Israel set their faces on me that I should reign. Howbeit the kingdom is turned about and is become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord. And now I ask one petition of thee, deny me not." And she said unto him, "Say on." And he said, "Speak, I pray thee, unto Solomon the king, for he will not say thee nay, that he give me Abishag the Shumanite to wife." And Bathsheba said, "Well, I will speak for thee unto the king." Bathsheba therefore went unto King Solomon to speak unto him for Adonijah, and the king rose up to meet her, and bowed himself under her, and sat down on his throne, and caused a seat to be set for the king's mother, and she sat on his right hand. Then she said, I desire one small petition of thee, I pray thee, say me not nay. And the king said unto her, Say on, my mother, I will not say nay, thee nay. And she said, Let Abishag, this Sumanite, be given to Adonijah, the brother, to wife. And King Solomon answered and said unto his mother, And why dost thou ask Abishag, the Sumanite, for Adonijah? Ask for him the kingdom also, for he is mine elder brother, even for him, and for Abathar the priest, and for Joab the son of Zeruiah, or whatever that is. Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, saying, God do so to me, and more also, if Adonijah have not spoken this word against his own life. Now therefore, as the Lord liveth, which hath established me, and set me on the throne of David my father, and who hath made me a house, as he promised, Adonijah shall be put to death this day. And King Solomon sent by his hand of Benaniah, the son of Jedidiah, and he fell upon him, that he died. Now the reason was, is because that girl that that Adonijah wanted was part of Solomon's harem. And Adonijah knew that to own the harem was to own the kingdom. And that's what he was trying to do. He was trying to take over the king's harem. Well, that's what's going on here in our story too. Reuben is trying to take over Jacob's harem, starting with Bilhah, his concubine. He's trying to assert his power as firstborn and trying to take away the power of his father. Everybody understand that? The life today just isn't what it used to, what it was back then.
sort of
like herds of animals. Yeah, well,
we're happy about that.
No, here you can have her.
Yeah,
well, and Saul, and I bet he says Solomon didn't waste any time getting rid of Adonijah. You're exactly right. Well, but Solomon saw the threat. Solomon saw the threat. All he was asking was, I want this girl for my wife. But Solomon saw the threat. He says, does he want my kingdom also? And all, you know, everything. But he saw the threat and put an end to the threat. And had the older brother killed. Because that's exactly what he was trying to do. That's what is going on here. Reuben is trying to take over the power from Jacob. So, Jacob is, in fact, getting older. And as the 12 sons are growing up, they will increase and Jacob will decrease. Because the covenant blessing will pass from just one man to 12 sons, who will then have children and grandchildren and on, and begin a nation. And the blessing will move on to them. So here, for the very first time, then really we get the listing of the 12 recipients of the covenant promises, and they're listed in order of their mothers here in Genesis 35, starting in verse 23. The sons of Leah are Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and Simeon and Levi and Judah, Issachar and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's handmaid, Dan and Naphtali. The sons of Zilpah, Leah's handmaid, Gad and Asher. These are the sons of Jacob, which were born to him in Padanaram. So then Jacob returns home to Isaac. After, of course, being so long ashamed to face Isaac, he finally returns home to reconcile. And even though you get sort of the feeling like he barely makes it home in time to see Isaac die, the fact of the matter is, if you do the math, Jacob made it home about 10 years before Isaac's death. And so he was home for that long before Isaac did, in fact, die. Jacob came unto Isaac, his father, unto Mamre, and unto the city of Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned, and the days of Isaac were 180 years, 180 years. And Jacob and Esau then buried Isaac, and there's no mention of any kind of hostility, which suggests that they made full reconciliation one with the other. And Isaac gave up the ghost and died, and was gathered unto his people, being old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. So it would suggest, like I say, that they were fine with each other and got along just wonderfully. Now, the only things I really have to say about the lessons that we learn in this story, that Jacob did, in fact, after last week where we saw Jacob just moving further and further away from God and letting things happen that certainly he should not have let happen, and was being just apathetic about amazing things, the rape of his daughter and going about setting up an alliance with the Canaanites that would allow intermarrying with them. Jacob finally renewed a relationship with God, which was basically necessitated by the sinful conditions his life that in his life that were really getting him into trouble. When you hang around trouble, sooner or later trouble is going to find you and going to get you in so deep that it's going to take the work of God to get you out. So when he got to that point, he was finally ready to listen to God. The one thing that we all know, hopefully, is that even when we do have a good working relationship with God, it doesn't mean that everything in life is always going to go smoothly. There are consequences to past sins, and we will reap what we have sown. And that means even when we're at the point in our lives when we're at the most spiritual level and have a great relationship with God, oftentimes past sins and past errors will come back and haunt us. So it's just the way things are, because sin has a way of reminding us that we did have those lives prior to knowing God. We are called to sanctification. Jacob wanted to live and be right there in the thick of it, just sort of like Lot. He just couldn't stay away from the city. He couldn't stay away from Sodom. And Jacob wanted to live right there with the Canaanites. We're called to sanctification, separation from that lifestyle. And as long as we insist on living with the world, then we're going to live a life that's apart from God. If we do that reconciliation with men when we have problems, it's difficult. It's difficult. So it's hard to be unreconciled with God and men at the same time. If God has a purpose for your life, if you're a Christian, God does have a purpose for your life. And we can fight God, we can fight God's purpose. But God wanted Jacob to take a journey and had a destination for him to get to, and that destination was where he was where Isaac was, where Abraham had sojourned, where Isaac had sojourned. He wanted Jacob to go back there. And Jacob did everything in his power to prolong the journey, to go the wrong way, to go this way, that way, to do everything. He built a house and then pitched his tent in the city. And he did everything possible to go everywhere except where he was supposed to go. But you can dilly-dally around, you can fight God, but God will get you to that perfect, you know, that place sooner or later. God's purpose will not be thwarted. And like I say, you can fight with Him, but oftentimes it's easier to listen to God's purpose and go along with it. Just listen to it and do it. You know, like Romans 8:28, the old verse, and we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to His purpose. For whom He did foreknow, He did also predestinate to be conformed to the image of His Son, that we might be the firstborn among many brethren. You know, if we're predestinated to be conformed, God's going to do it. Whether we fight Him or whether we give in, He is going to conform you one way or the other. He's got a purpose in your life. You're going to, you know, that purpose is going to stand whether you fight Him and go kicking and screaming and hollering, or whether you go willingly. You know, Jacob went kicking and screaming. But you know, in the end, he had to go. And he had to give in, and he had to do what God intended for him, and he finally went willingly because he had to. And sooner or later, that's what happens to everybody. You know, they get to the point where they have to do what God intends them to do. All right.